righty, we're back, 8:32. Lots happening on the national front, as we all know, ladies and gentlemen. David Birdsell, Mark Stinney, the Austin W. Mark School of Public and International Affairs over at the Great Baruch College. Nice enough to give us a couple of minutes. David, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am doing quite well. You know, I was thinking about this last night and this whole thing with the impeachment inquiry. And we know where everything is right now with the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, she has a right to do that, to call an immediate House vote to authorize such an inquiry. And, you know, it's interesting with the White House pretty much informing her, I guess the executive branch will not play a role along with this inquiry, it seems, that some of the House Democrats have been part of. You know, and listen, the president has quite fairly kangaroo court, quote unquote. But it's interesting to me here, David, and tell me if I'm wrong, while the Constitution, you know, clearly gives the House the power to begin such a proceeding, does it give Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House that privilege as well by declaring it all by herself, the entire inquiry here?
There is nothing in the Constitution that says exactly how an impeachment inquiry needs to begin. As a matter of practice, historically, the House has convened a vote to commence impeachment proceedings, but that was a notion cobbled together at the time, not responsive to any governing statute. So the Speaker's position at the outset was that it was perfectly legitimate to convene an impeachment inquiry without such a vote, with only two precedents previously, right, leading up to that moment. And of course, should an impeachment, should articles of impeachment be filed, then there would need to be a majority vote of the House in order to sustain those articles of impeachment. So the idea on the part of the administration that a House vote is required to inaugurate impeachment proceedings is not supported by any statute. It is supported by precedent. And the Speaker has the ability, certainly, to craft articles of impeachment as a first step in the inquiry, but it's not under any obligation, again, by any governing statute to do so.
You're right. The two presidents cited, Nixon and Clinton. Precedent, you know, could be on the side of the White House here when you think about it. I mean, obviously, they voted to open impeachment inquiries against those two presidents. And in doing so, I guess they set the rules that gave those defending presidential rights full rights to participate, I guess, including the right to subpoena witnesses, correct?
Well, typically, this is a proceeding in the legislature. So, the president's party, that is the impeached president or the president being investigated in the course of an impeachment hearing, would be represented in fashion by members of his party. The notion that the executive branch itself has the capacity to call witnesses, et cetera, is not supported by the record. And one of the major questions here, and this has always been true, and again, we have very, very little precedent to go on. We're talking about, within the modern context, two presidents. But one of the big questions has always been, what are the powers of the Congress to discover evidence and compel witnesses to testify? And the executive branch tries to exert executive privilege. That was true in the case of Richard Nixon. It was true in the case of Bill Clinton, but never to the blanket extent that the Trump administration has declared now. And that's really the one of the several, but certainly one among the major constitutional questions. In the previous two cases, the House would say, we want to hear from this person. And the administration would make a case for executive privilege for that person. In this case, they're asserting a blanket executive privilege where basically nobody in government needs to comply with an investigation by the House. And I don't think that there is any precedent for an administration that is now suddenly supposedly concerned with precedent for that kind of broad stroke Baroque exclusion even being claimed, much less exercised by failure to cooperate with the Congress.
These committees have to provide, I would think, disclosure of all the evidence favorable to the president, all evidence being on the credibility of witnesses called to testify in this inquiry, I would think, David. I mean, these current procedures that we are witnessing here have at least proved none of these basic constitutional rights from what I'm gathering out here. Listen, to me, there seems to be plenty of holes in this whole deal.
Well, this is not a trial. The best way to think about this is the relationship between a grand jury and a trial jury. The role the House serves here is to examine whether there is evidence to support and to conclude that a president has violated the terms of the oath of office to such an extent that warrant removal from office. That charge is then referred to the Senate, and the Senate basically tries the case. So the Senate, with a two-thirds majority required to sustain the impeachment, and remember, we've never actually impeached a president. The House voted to impeach Bill Clinton. That referral was made to the Senate. The Senate failed to convict, as it were, to actually sustain the articles of impeachment and remove him from office. Richard Nixon, knowing that he would be convicted in the Senate, decided to withdraw and resign his office. So we don't have a precedent for how this turns out if the Senate were ever to sustain. But that's where you have something more nearly resembling a trial situation. Certainly the process of gathering information does not require the same level of scrutiny of witnesses as would be necessary in a court of law. We're not talking about a question of guilt or innocence with regard to a criminal statute. We're talking about evidence of behavior. And right now, the evidence that we have, the administration's own release of the close notes on the conversation with the president of Ukraine, are deeply, deeply concerning to most people who have gauged their expectations of presidential conduct on what every president has done prior.
And I'm not defending the president in any way. I thought it was a phone call that probably should not have been made, a conversation probably that should not have been had. But what I'm viewing is the process of what's happening right here. It's almost like a lynch mob where you have Pelosi's team, to me at least, David Birdsell, seems to be rushing to a final impeachment vote before Thanksgiving. I mean, listen, they're deposing witnesses behind closed doors. Certainly you can't like that. And they're denying fair time to ask questions of Republicans and the right to call even their own witnesses. Not even to release the full interview transcripts. I mean, the whole process to me is flawed as far as what Pelosi and the Democrats are doing right now. They're leaking negative information, withholding favorable facts, feeding this anti-Trump media to repeat these interpretations that simply are just not true. And I think the entire process at this point in time is flawed. And again, not agreeing with the process of the phone call that was made, the process thereafter I'm talking about.
Well, I think that to put this another way, it would be best if we had a process where all of the information gathered by the committees were available for public scrutiny up to and that is not including the release of names of whistleblowers. And this is a very clear protection in law that whistleblowers need to be whistleblowers are protected by statute. And the notion is that what they're doing is sufficiently risky personally and professionally that if they were required to come forward and disclose names as opposed to provide documentary evidence to suggest names of others who could testify to the same things that they observed, that we would never have any whistleblowers and that it would just be too daunting a task to have it. And this is not new. These are laws that go back to the 1970s. So the whistleblower protections seem to me to have to be a bright line, very much in the same way that certain kinds of grand jury testimony is protected, and the identities of the people who testified protected. But up to that point, I couldn't agree more that we need to have all of the evidence available for public scrutiny, and there is no chance that the Democrats or anybody else will build any popular support for impeachment lacking that transparency.
David Birdsall with us, Baruch. So let's move on to another area. And I said a couple of things this morning, and I know you're following this story regarding China and the NBA. Does it get lower at all for the National Basketball Association disgracing themselves? And I called it kowtowing, David, to this Beijing regime. And I'm talking about the GM of the Rockets team, Daryl Morey, with his tweet of support for Hong Kong protesters a couple of days ago. I believe it was Fight for Freedom, Stand with Hong Kong. I mean, is that controversial? I don't know. But when you think about it, who wouldn't say words of encouragement? Who wouldn't stand with those protesters trying to advance democracy against, call it, as I put it earlier, just an overweening imperial dictatorship, what's going on there? I think the NBA is completely out of line not standing behind Daryl Morey and his tweet. It's all about the dollars. It's all about the sneakers that are being sold over there in China. I think it is a black eye beyond as far as the NBA is concerned.
I think there's absolutely no question about that. And it's not unique to the NBA. This is just a particularly public case from an organization that has actually been fairly unbuttoned with regard to players and coaches expressing their political feelings domestically in the past. Of course, the NBA is very interested in the Chinese market. You have 1.3 billion people, and you think about those sneaker contacts. That's contracts. That's 2.6 billion feet. It's kind of a tantalizing opportunity. But as many American businesses have found, it comes at the expense of being able to for the organization itself or your employees to express political opinions. It comes at the expense for manufacturing operations of turning over basic manufacturing process information, which is often completely devolved onto a Chinese counterpart country that learns to do what you do. The NBA may not have quite that same manufacturing problem, but they have very, very visible players. And this is, of course, what concerns the Chinese government. And it makes very, very plain to everybody what the costs of doing business in China are. If it is a market too large to ignore, you have to ask the question about what it is that you leave behind when you seek economic rewards in that environment. A very, very important issue that is much bigger than the NBA, but the NBA is making it visible to a large majority of Americans who may not have seen it up close and personal before.
No question. We'll see how it pans out, but they canceled the game, I believe, already today in Shanghai.
Yep.
Regarding the Lakers. And you know, it's interesting. And listen, I'm not disparaging anybody's thought processes here as far as the NBA players itself. But really, if you polled a superstar whose jerseys are being sold, whose sneakers are being sold, can they tell you in depth as far as the magnitude of what is happening between protesters of Hong Kong and the and China? I mean, can you really go? I mean, not to get too political as far as players are concerned. In essence, it kind of, you know, the question kind of has arisen in my head, at least, as far as what is at the center of it all here, you know? I mean, that's really part of the issue in my mind. And again, you know, you have greed and power just taking over the reins.
Well, under Chairman Xi Jinping, China has very consistently, and this has now been about 6 years into his leadership of the country, which turned sharply from what his predecessors were doing and relatively more openness, relatively more freedom of expression. And he's done several things. In addition to clamping down on free expression, he's also reasserted Chinese interests throughout the South China Sea. If you're an airline doing business in China, you are not allowed to say that your plane is flying to Taiwan. You can say that it's flying to Taipei in China, but since China claims Taiwan, even though Taiwan doesn't feel claimed by China, people have been, airlines have been knuckling under, even to the point of your arrival and departure boards can't make mention of a politically inconvenient fact of nationhood if you want to do business with Beijing. Do the players understand all of this? I don't know. There are some very sophisticated people playing basketball in the NBA. But I think it's very, very easy whenever we're dealing with any global supply chain to lose track of the conditions under which goods are manufactured, services are provided, and what kinds of agreements companies enter into, what scrutiny they need to open themselves to when they're doing business in those environments. And we're seeing this play out in real time with the NBA right now. And I think the circumstances are regrettable, but I think it's a wonderful object lesson in the sense that everybody understands basketball. And everybody understands right now what's at stake for the NBA and what kind of compromises they're willing to make to pursue business in the largest nation by population in the world.
David Birdsell with us out of Baruch. I'll tell you one more hot one that really has gone under the radar in the last couple of days, David, is, you know, what's happening between, you know, Turkey and northern Syria. Now, Turkey, it's interesting. If you're following this story, folks, Turkey has said its military will cross the border into northern Syria. That could come at any time. And it's interesting, David, you know, that comes from a tweet sent out earlier today from, I believe it was Turkey's communications director. And this after the president, Donald Trump, agreed to move troops out of that part of northern Syria. So Turkey basically has a green light to attack the Kurdish forces when Turkey considers a threat there. Now, it's going to be very interesting to me to see what happens here. You have a lot on both sides of the aisle from a political standpoint that says, really, Trump's decision to abandon the Kurds, I mean, let's face it, they were instrumental in the fight against ISIS. You know, that's a kind of a betrayal there. You got an interesting mindset happening right now between the president of the United States, the Kurds, Turkey, the whole thing. What's happening over there?
It couldn't be a much more complicated mess, and it defies quick explanation. But let me just make a couple of observations. You're absolutely right. The Kurdish fighters were really our saviors on the ground in the fight against ISIS. They created pressure from the northern border, pushing into Iraq and pushing into Syria. And to this very day are the people who are supervising the largest number of ISIS prisoners still on the ground in Syria. And there's no question that if we walk away from that area, that we are leaving the Kurds exposed to Turkish attack. Remember the hostility between the Kurdish peoples and other Turkish peoples, and particularly governments of Turkey going back decades now, is an old, old question. And the regions which are in southeastern Turkey and into northwestern Iraq, those are areas that Turkey has long wanted to quell and suppress. There's been a low-grade war going on for decades. This basically turns the whole question back over to the Turks and exposes the Kurds. It is a betrayal, in my view, of a stalwart American ally and hard to explain. And it's going to be very hard for the United States to say credibly, we've got your back, when we're asking the next group of proxy fighters to take on any burden for the United States if this is the reward that they reap for that service.
It's tough to abandon the Kurds, as I said prior. I mean, how instrumental were they going against ISIS? I mean, that to me, I mean, that is unbelievable. But you know what? It's a tough decision without question. We'll see how it pans out. But a very interesting set of circumstances, my friend. We shall see. Can't thank you enough for a couple of minutes. Some crazy stuff, interesting stuff happening. We'll see what the next couple of days brings.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
There you go, a late edition. Always welcome, though. David Birdsell, Marks Dean of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs over at Baruch College.